From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dapp.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.
On this vote, the yeas are 54, the nays are 35. Three-fifths of the senators duly chosen and sworn not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
And just like that, the first Republican filibuster of Biden's presidency has killed an effort to set up an independent commission to investigate the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The measure failed to reach the 60 votes needed. Only six Republicans voted for it. The majority of Republicans condemned the commission. They said it wasn't necessary, fueled by partisan politics. The family of Brian Sicknick, however, the Capitol police officer who died after trying to stop the mob, pled with senators to pass this commission bill. Here's Sicknick's partner, Sandra Garza, what she said to reporters.
I think it's very disturbing that anyone would not want to support this. I mean, why would they not want to get to the bottom of such horrific violence?
Let's take a deeper look with our political roundtable. Jesse Holland is host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Jesse, good to have you back.
Thank you so much.
And NPR White House correspondent Ayesha Roscoe is here. Ayesha, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And why don't we start with you, Ayesha? Tell us what happened today in the United States Senate.
Well, what essentially happened was Republicans were unwilling to support this bipartisan commission that, you know, Democrats have been trying to put together. There had been concessions made, but it was not enough. And it was clear. I mean, in this case, a lot of Republicans did not even stick around for the vote, but you still needed 60. And this is a key example of how the filibuster can be used to stop legislation that a lot of people, and certainly the administration and Democrats, say is really important and necessary for an assault on the Capitol, one of the worst assaults on the Capitol that has been seen in America's history.
Well, there were signs that this was coming. Here's Mitch McConnell speaking on the Senate floor yesterday.
I do not believe the additional extraneous commission that Democratic leaders want would uncover crucial new facts or promote healing. Frankly, I do not believe it is even designed to do that.
So, Jesse, this is the same Mitch McConnell who railed against the former president after January 6th. Why weren't more moderate Republicans able to get on board with this? And are you at all surprised also that meetings with Officer Sicknick's family didn't persuade more Republicans?
Well, if you think back, anybody who's paid attention to Washington politics saw this coming from a mile away. If you think back, Ronald Reagan's first rule was thou shalt not speak ill of any Republican. The Mitch McConnell caveat added to that, especially with an election coming up. So there was no way that Republicans were going to sign on to a panel that would talk about how President Trump's supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol and attempted to overthrow the government, especially with a crucial midterm coming up. Regardless of what that panel would have found, what it, in Republicans' minds, what it would have done is what it would have reminded independent voters that it was supporters of President Trump that almost overthrew the federal government there in the U.S. Capitol. And there was no way Republicans were going to sign on to that, especially since they're already worried about how these midterm elections are going to turn out.
Well, Jesse, I have a question for you. Democrats could still create a committee or a panel to investigate, right? What could be the next move here?
Well, there, as Ayesha was saying earlier, there could be several dominoes that could fall from this right here. First of all, there are investigations going on already. Democrats run both the House and the Senate. There's nothing stopping them from doing an investigation on their own. But if they do, it becomes a partisan investigation, and Republicans then just say, this isn't worth it, the Democrats are out to get us. Or this could be the first step to Democrats deciding to get rid of the Senate filibuster and just moving forward with a majority vote.
There's a lot to watch for on this, for sure. Let's talk about something that is getting some traction and some movement. President Biden's ambitious infrastructure plan. This week, Republicans came out with a nearly $1 trillion counteroffer. It's hundreds of billions of dollars less, though, than Biden's proposal. Here's Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito.
We can't seem to get the White House to agree on a definition or a scope of infrastructure that matches where we think it is, and that's physical core infrastructure. The White House is still bringing their human infrastructure into this package, and that's just a non-starter for us.
And that was Capito on CNBC yesterday. What does she mean by that, and what are the major differences between these proposals, Aisha?
Well, the major difference is when she's talking about human infrastructure is that the Biden administration not only wants money for roads and bridges and broadband, they want money for caretaking. They want money to rebuild VA hospitals. They say that these are issues that affect people who need to go to work. So they need someone to care for the elderly and their family. But so that is one place where they're apart. But they're even more far apart than it would appear, because even that almost $1 trillion plan that the GOP came out with, that's actually mostly money that's already, obligated. It's not new money. The new spending is just $257 billion. So they're even more far apart than what it would appear, because all of the money that the White House is proposing is new money.
So now what, Jesse? Are we getting closer and closer to reconciliation here from the Democrats?
Well, one thing that we can say for sure is that all of this is moving Democrats toward the idea that Republicans will never agree to anything. So conservative Democrats, you might want to rethink what your original positions were on the filibuster. Now, Democrats can push some things through, but the end game right now is trying to get conservative senators like Joe Manchin to realize that Republicans are not going to agree to any proposals from the White House. So why are we continually to coddle them and allow them to block everything? So there may be some movement toward some type of negotiations here, but I think the end game is trying to convince conservative Democrats that Republicans are not going to agree to anything.
Well, that's not going to be easy, because you have Joe Manchin, but you also have Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. They have both been pretty clear they are not interested in changing those rules. Let's move on to Paul Ryan, former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who spoke out against the former president, Donald Trump, at a speech at the Reagan National Library last night. Let's listen.
Voters looking for Republican leaders want to see independents in metal. They will not be impressed by the sight of yes men and flatterers flocking to Mar-a-Lago. We win majorities by directing our loyalty and respect to voters and by staying faithful to the conservative principles that unite us.
Aisha, what are you hearing there from Paul Ryan?
Well, I think what I'm hearing is Paul Ryan is out of touch with his own party, because I don't know that there's any evidence that the Republican base will punish people for being loyal to Donald Trump. In fact, it's the exact opposite. And I think that even in his speech, he did not name Trump. He mentioned Mar-a-Lago, but he wouldn't even, name drop Trump. And so I think that in and of itself shows the power of Trump that he has over this party. And I think anyone would, looking at the Republican Party of today, would say that this is the party of Donald Trump. This is not the party of Paul Ryan.
Aisha and Jesse, with the few minutes we have with you, something else this week. It's been 1 year since George Floyd's murder. Biden wanted to sign a police reform bill into law by now, but Congress missed that deadline. But there are signs of progress we're seeing. Here's Democratic Senator Cory Booker on CNN Sunday speaking about his colleague, the only black Republican in the Senate, Tim Scott.
I wouldn't have a negotiating partner in Tim Scott if Mitch McConnell didn't believe that this is something that we should be at the table trying to work through. We are on the Senate side in working in good faith to bring this to a conclusion.
Tim Scott's been working on this issue for more than a year. Jesse, how close are the two sides to a compromise?
Well, we all hope that they're getting closer and closer to a compromise. But unfortunately, I think the reality is that politics in Washington make it very difficult to come up with something that all of the Republican senators and all of the Democratic senators can agree to. So here's hoping that we'll get something sometime this year. But the idea that we're going to see a police reform coming out of the Senate anytime soon, I think, is just not realistic. We love to work on, try to move things around anniversaries, but unfortunately, Washington politics don't normally work that way.
Aisha, your thoughts. You know, 1 year after this murder, thinking over the past year, has Washington really moved forward with the kind of racial justice priorities that President Biden wants to see?
No, I mean, the short answer is no. There has been a lot of rhetoric. There's been talk about equity, but what the country has not seen at the federal level is real action and change. Now, you have had the Justice Department start a civil rights investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department, so you do have that. But the president promised that there would be movement, and he's pointing to the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, and that simply has not happened. And so until something gets passed, that is going to be a mark against something that he promised to try to get done.
Aisha Roscoe is NPR's White House correspondent, and Jesse Holland is a host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Thank you both for joining us, and happy Memorial Day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before the pandemic, when we talked about air quality, we usually meant the air outside. Smog, smoke, pollution. But those conversations usually ended at the front door. The virus has made many of us think about indoor air quality in a whole new way. The Mountain West News Bureau's Maggie Mullen reports.
At the daycare center at the University of Wyoming, you see a lot of what you'd expect. Toys, books, cubbies for tiny shoes. And that's not all.
We've got air purifiers, we've got CO2 detectors.
That's Mark Bittner. He's in charge of this place. He says those machines were added to reduce the risk of catching COVID-19.
I just really needed to find a way to help mitigate. Okay, what can we do now that we know these things are airborne? We have kids that some of them are too young to wear masks, so what can we do to help protect the children, help protect the staff that are here a little bit better?
The daycare's HVAC system got a boost to recirculate air more frequently, and each classroom now has an air purifier. And then there's the CO2 device.
It's not measuring COVID in the air, it's just measuring CO2 levels.
Here's why that's useful. CO2 is what we breathe out, so if there's a lot of it in a room, the air isn't fresh. You're more likely to breathe in the same air someone else just breathed out. And if the CO2 detector shows numbers on the higher end, Bittner says it's still not as if an alarm goes off.
It's not a panic, it's just find ways to move the air a little bit better.
Like opening a window or turning on a fan. These kinds of mitigation efforts happened all over the country as people were thinking hard about indoor air, many for the very first time.
As a result, most of us in this field have been working nonstop.
That's Shelley Miller, a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Colorado Boulder.
To try to communicate, provide interviews, write articles, put stuff on Twitter, just like any way we can possibly get the word out.
Get the word out about indoor air quality. Miller says historically, people have paid way more attention to the air outside. And even that started not so long ago.
We only realized in the 1950s that air pollution could kill you because of the London outbreak.
She's talking about the Great Smog of 1952, 5 days of disastrous air pollution, thanks to unusually frigid and windless weather combined with pollution from burning coal. Here's how the BBC described it.
The sky and the light were blotted out, and London coughed and crawled almost to a standstill in murky yellow gloom.
The Great Smog shut down the city and caused thousands of deaths, and it spurred the UK's Clean Air Act of 1956. People realized that if we want clean air, the government needs to regulate it. And just as importantly, Miller says it gave way to thinking about outdoor air as a public good, something we all share. But she says we haven't come around to that kind of thinking for indoor air.
What's happened with indoor air is that it's become a private good. This is your home. This is your space. The government is not going to invade your space or your home or your office building.
But better air quality at home can keep you healthy in a number of ways, filtering allergens, dust, as well as pathogens that make you sick. It's possible the COVID-19 pandemic could trigger change the way the Great Smog did. It could be a paradigm shift for indoor air. In fact, 39 scientists are calling for just that in a recent report published in the journal Science. Miller and her CU Boulder colleague and aerosol expert Jose Luis Jimenez are two of those researchers.
So our society has been very successful at removing pathogens from water or from food, and they are very, you know, complex, sophisticated systems that work very, very well.
But Jimenez says we're not there yet with indoor air.
Something our society just hasn't done it.
Jimenez and others say it's time for that change. The group of researchers wants to see standards for indoor air quality that include airborne pathogens and that are enforced. But that doesn't all have to be complicated or even expensive. He says it can be as simple as plugging in a $100 CO2 detector and, if need be, opening a window. For Here Now, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Okay, the generational battle continues. Millennials get a kick out of calling anyone older than them boomers, while the boomers chide millennials for refusing to grow up. And now there's a new way to get a millennial into a tizzy. Call them geriatric. That's apparently a thing online. And for that, let's bring in Femi Oke. She's the host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She joins us, as she does every Friday, to analyze culture and conversations on social media. Hey, Femi.
Hi there, Tonya.
Okay, break this down for us. Who is considered a geriatric millennial?
Okay, you are a geriatric millennial if you were born between the years of 1980 and 1985. So you're in good company if that is you. Lin-Manuel Miranda, Beyonce, Prince Harry, Kim Kardashian, Mark Zuckerberg, they're all geriatric millennials. And there are many terms used to describe this micro-generation. Indie posts on Twitter. Shout out to everyone born between 1980 to 1985. You've been Gen X, Gen Y, Millennial, the Oregon Trail Generation, Xennial, an Elder, Millennia, and now, checks notes, Geriatric Millennial. So most of these are made up labels, Tonya, just to market people. So
oh,
they
I
can
know.
Have some kind of identity going on. Simone Kadiri just found out about geriatric millennials on Facebook. Have a listen.
You know, earlier in the week, I heard about this whole geriatric millennial thing. And I want you to know, whoever coined this phrase, I was highly, highly offended. Okay.
Oh, I'm highly offended that she's offended. Okay. This really, this just fires me up, Femi. I can't explain it, but continue.
It's really tough. Yeah. So Simone is sitting there making this recording for Facebook with her head in her hands, generally upset that she knew she was a millennial, but she didn't know she was an old millennial. Tonya.
All right. Explain where this term comes from, though. How did it go viral?
All right, so there's a writer called Erica Dewan, and she focuses often on leadership issues. And she wrote a post in Medium a few weeks ago, and she uses the term geriatric millennial. And the piece is called Why the Hybrid Workforce of the Future Depends on the Geriatric Millennial. Talks about tech and social skills of people born between 1980 and 1985. They're digitally savvy, but they also pick up on social cues because those social cues were honed before social media took off. They have used phones for talking. They've met dates in real life. And they also have TikTok accounts. So they have a special set of skills. So this piece was basically complimentary. It says that older millennials are great leaders. They straddle digital and analog life, and they connect with the generations above them and the generations younger than them really easily. But Erica describes herself as a geriatric millennial. She didn't invent the term, but she embraces it. But what people were really upset was with the word geriatric. That was what caused the biggest reaction. A lot of people said, I've never commented on an article on Medium before, but... And lots of people were upset that they were being called geriatric when they were basically just middle-aged. A different reaction came from NBC's Today Show, Jenna Bush Hager and Hoda Kotb. Jenna was born in 1981, and actually she was feeling quite positive about this new label. Have a listen.
The fact that I'm even a millennial,
yes, that's a shocker,
shocked me. Right? I'm so thrilled. I have three children and a mortgage, and I'm go to bed at 7:45, and I usually fall asleep during 60 Minutes on Sunday nights. I haven't gone to a bar since 2007.
So people are, believe it or not, Tonya, they're adding geriatric millennial to their social media profiles, and there are even more memes out now to torture millennials as if there weren't already enough of them.
You know what, Femi? I mean, we're laughing about it. I'm talking about how it makes me angry that they're talking about being geriatric. But really, why do you think millennials overall are so sensitive about age? I mean, does this really reveal just general anxiety about getting older and the place they sit, you know, in society and at the time when they were coming of age during, you know, our economic crisis?
I think if we look at the way that millennials have been portrayed over the years, they took a lot of burden on and they were the butt of many jokes, but they were always cool and young. And so what is happening here is social identity politics on social media, and that happens a lot, and a lot of it is teasing. But I think the one thing that my biggest takeaway was from, nobody wants to be labelled, and ageism is still alive and well. But my takeaway also is, it's about digital communication. It does give people an idea of where you are generationally, not across the board, but what was around technologically when you were young. What did you use? How are you adapting and using it? Are you a digital native? Are you not? And we all know people who are in their 80s and 90s and have got TikTok accounts. And then we also know people who are in their 40s who can barely send an email. So it's a huge generalization. I think the pushback is against the generalization of this term. But also, just remember...
You heard Peter. Peter's in here. You know, he's
actually...
He's
made up.
Just, Peter, he is a geriatric millennial.
Can I ask you know that emoji where you kind of like raise your hand a little bit and you say, yeah, that's me. No,
that's
1981.
You. That's
you. Right here. I am geriatric, though.
Brilliant. You are GM, Peter.
Impressive.
You make a good
all
point,
young.
Though.
We're all young.
I'm thinking
whatever.
Like, you know, I turned 50. 40 a couple, like last month, and I'm like, yes, you know, something is shifting in my life, and geriatric has a certain feel to it now, doesn't it?
Femi, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Host of the stream in Al Jazeera English.
You're welcome.
It's been 100 years since the massacre that wiped out a thriving black neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
No one has been compensated for the homes, for the businesses that they lost. They returned to the Greenwood District, and there was absolutely nothing.
Listen on the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
$6 trillion. That's how much President Biden is proposing for federal spending next year. His budget was released today, and it would amount to the highest sustained level of federal spending since World War II, with investments in transportation, education, and combating climate change. Let's take a closer look now with Michael Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Peter.
So, of course, this is something that would need to pass Congress. It's far from becoming law, but if you view this as a vision statement from the president, what does it say about his vision?
Well, right. You're absolutely right. It's more a wish list than the actual budget that will pass. But as far as his statement, Peter, I think the main priorities are he wants to kind of bolster the safety net for the less affluent, the sort of more at-risk members of our society. So, you know, more education spending, more social welfare type of spending, and, you know, programs to allow people to, you know, get the child care they need to pursue better employment, that sort of thing. As well, on the other hand, is also a priority to sort of repair a lot of the infrastructure in the country that's needed, stuff like bridges and roads, and bolstering the green energy infrastructure in the country as well. So kind of a two-handed priority from this administration.
And that $6 trillion figure, how does that compare to other recent budgets from other presidents?
You know, so it's big as far as just the dollar number. For example, 2019, the budget was about $3.5 trillion. Last year was about $3.8 trillion. Now, remember, the government often spends more than even what's budgeted because of emergency spending, like last year during the pandemic, or God forbid if there's another war. That type of spending usually gets tacked on to what was already budgeted. So, pure dollar figure, it's the highest ever. When you talk about it being the highest since World War II, that is as relative to the entire economy, gross domestic product, a percentage of that. So that's where you get that sort of highest since World War II figure.
I see. Now, Republicans have been very critical of the president's proposed spending. Let's get into that a little bit. Where would the money come from?
Well, partly undo some of the very deep cuts to the corporate tax rate that Trump had implemented during his presidency. Also, a big increase in the capital gains taxes. Those are taxes that people pay on the profit they make from investments. But otherwise, it's like any other year, almost every other year of our lifetime, in that it'll be paid for by issuing debt in the Treasury market.
It would bring the deficit above $1.8 trillion. That's another thing that Republicans are talking about now. Put that number into context.
Right. Again, it's the type of thing where you can look at it a couple different ways. In pure dollar terms, the only other times when the deficit was above a trillion was when the economy was really struggling. Last year, for example, and about 4 years after the global financial crisis. So this will be the first time we've had projected trillion-dollar-plus deficits going forward. But again, if you look at it as a percentage of the total economy, it's not at that sort of superlative level. There were other periods where relatively to the total economy, the deficit was bigger. But it is certainly still elevated historically.
And we'll say it again, this is a wish list. It is not the law yet, and it's tough to get anything through Congress these days. Senior editor at Bloomberg News, Mike Regan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Here and now.
Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors is leaving the organization's foundation effective today. Cullors says she plans to focus on other projects, including her second book and a TV development deal with Warner Brothers. Her departure, she says, has been in the works for more than a year and was not prompted by recent attacks from right-wing groups. Her announcement comes as the nation this week marked the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd, who died under the knee of a police officer in Minneapolis on May 25, 2020. In the days following his death, people took to the streets worldwide to protest. Support surged for Black Lives Matter, a movement that began in 2013 and a viral online hashtag. Today, there's still lots of support for the movement online. Posts on social media continue to call for racial justice and an end to police brutality. But there are also posts that are riddled with disinformation. Activists charge that it's part of an overall effort to undermine Black Lives Matter and its message. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
Log on to a social media account, and there's a myriad of posts about Black Lives Matter, including plenty of disparaging ones, like this one, that falsely claims the government has identified it as a terrorist group. Another that circulated widely claimed that BLM activists had badly beaten a group of elderly white people. That post has been debunked by fact-checkers who found the photos were taken in South Africa years ago, and it has been taken down. However, Jordan Geiger, an organizer with Black Lives Matter in Indiana, says there's still plenty of disinformation online designed to cause confusion and distrust.
Like reports circulating that BLM is going to vandalize businesses in downtown areas, that we are targeting specific white communities, those kinds of things. It makes our supporters say, okay, I don't want to get involved in that, right? And so when disinformation just goes unchecked, folks will believe it if you don't get ahead of it or respond to it appropriately.
Geiger says that's why BLM launched an effort to stop disinformation and urges people to send in details about suspicious posts or stories to the Black Lives Matter website. When Black Palante, a nonpartisan group created after the 2016 presidential election, also monitors disinformation aimed at people of color, hundreds of organizers across the country formed a digital war room during last year's election. They tracked bots that automatically send out scripted disinformation, often from Russia or other foreign governments trying to sow discord in the U.S. And they tracked what are known as digital blackface accounts that steal images to masquerade as black people and spread disinformation. Ashley Bryant, one of the co-leaders of When Black Palante, says they also found conspiracy theories about Black Lives Matter.
That went everything from George Floyd not being dead to, you know, George Soros funding protests, and then the full-out attacks on Black Lives Matter, where there's foreign actors, there's fake accounts pretending to be Antifa, all to actually just build this violent narrative around Black Lives Matter.
University of North Carolina professor Dean Freeland studies digital politics. He points to specific instances of disinformation about Black Lives Matter protesters engaging in violence.
There was a false story about a Black Lives Matter allied protester setting fires in Oregon, so connecting to the wildfires there. The claim that Black Lives Matter is white-led. There's been some Spanish language disinformation.
Freeland says Twitter has been vigilant about rooting out state-sponsored disinformation from foreign actors. Facebook says it's taken several steps, too, including working with nonpartisan and independent fact-checkers to root out the spread of fake stories. Information proven to be false can be removed for violating social media standards. That's not the case when it comes to posts online that are technically considered an opinion. Freeland says that's harder to combat.
Examples there include things like the notion that BLM is anti-white, which, of course, is an opinion, that it is a hate group, that it's somehow anti-family, that it is morally equivalent to far-right groups. And then there are some things that kind of blur the line between fact and opinion.
Critics of Black Lives Matter say it's the movement's supporters that are getting duped.
I feel that Black Lives Matter is one of the greatest sources of this information.
Mike Gonzalez is a senior fellow with the Heritage Foundation. He's the author of an upcoming book about Black Lives Matter and Marxism.
They have good Americans, well-intentioned Americans, who do not want to see racial injustice, and rightly so, putting up signs on their lawn about Black Lives Matter. They have manipulated the good nature of many people who think what they're doing, in my view, is trying to promote a philosophy that is not going to be good for this country, will destroy this country, and will destroy our way of life.
And then right-wing pundits like Rudy Giuliani, Candace Owens, and Carol Swain amplify often baseless anti-BLM messages to wider audiences.
Black Lives Matter wants to come and take your house away from you. They want to take your property away from you.
Yeah. Far-left crazy Antifa thugs who know exactly what they're doing.
Using black people to advance a Marxist agenda.
On our YouTube channel, Patrice Khan Cullors, one of the three co-founders of Black Lives Matters, responds.
I need to set the record straight. Am I a Marxist?
Khan Cullors says she does believe in Marxism, but laughs at the online comments that say she's pushing a communist agenda.
I'm working on making sure that people don't suffer. I'm working to make sure people don't go hungry. And these comments that I've received have been incredibly hurtful. It means that so many people aren't really taking our work very seriously.
The dean of the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard, Tomiko Brown-Nagin, says some of the disinformation surrounding Black Lives Matter could be from the old-style anti-civil rights playbook of the 1960s. Brown-Nagin says the FBI, under J. Edgar Hoover, and segregationists repeatedly used disinformation in an attempt to besmirch that movement.
So opponents characterize activists as lawbreakers or as violent when overwhelmingly they were nonviolent. Martin Luther King Jr. and members of his inner circle were said to be communists or communist sympathizers.
And like the civil rights movement back then, Black Lives Matter has seen its support both rise and decline after months of protests and the conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin. While polls show a large majority of African Americans continue to back the movement, overall support has dropped from record levels seen after George Floyd's death. How much of that loss is due to disinformation is difficult to measure, but what's certain is the battle over controlling what people believe about Black Lives Matter and its influence is ongoing. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
And Cheryl's story first aired on Morning Edition.
It
It is Memorial Day weekend, and we are on the verge of summer here, so let's take a moment to relive that wild play yesterday in a game between the Chicago Cubs and Pittsburgh Pirates. With two outs and a man on second base, Cubs batter Javi Baez is at the plate. Here comes the pitch.
Baez hits it on the ground to third, Gonzalez.
Let's pause the seemingly mundane call from the Marquee Sports Network right here, because this is where things get weird. The throw from third baseman Eric Gonzalez pulls the first baseman off the bag, which means Baez isn't out. The inning isn't over. In fact, Baez, who's sometimes called the magician or El Mago, sees an opportunity. Instead of going to first base to get tagged out, he starts running back toward home plate. Meanwhile, the Cubs player that was on second is now also sprinting toward home. Let's resume the call.
This is so good. Oh my goodness! Wow!
You gotta be kidding me! You've gotta be kidding me!
They stole a run!
The runner on second scored, and in the confusion, the Pirates throw the ball away, and Javi Baez ends up taking second base.
Keep going! Go! Go! You're invisible!
El Mago indeed.
That is unbelievable.
That is incredible.
Yahoo Sports described it differently, called it the dumbest play of the season. Cubs players erupted in laughter, and they giggled all the way to a 5-3 victory. And with that, go enjoy the unofficial start of summer. We hope it's better than the last.
Let's talk about the Yurchenko double pike. It's a gymnastics move that is so dangerous, only a handful of men have successfully executed it. And then there's Simone Biles. Biles is now the first woman to complete this move during last weekend's U.S. Classic competition. And of course, she's received high praise from the crowd, although the judges see it differently. They gave her a provisional scoring value of 6.6. That's close to what Biles' less intensive vaults have received. Joining us to talk more about this is Devorah Myers. She's a freelance journalist and author of the book, The End of the Perfect 10, The Making and Breaking of Gymnastics, Top Score from Nadia to Now. And Devorah, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. So first, can you explain the Yurchenko double pike and why it's so dangerous that gymnasts won't even practice doing it?
Well, I think it's very, you know, the Yurchenko technique, which is basically the round off back handspring entry, and then you do a backflip and then you do twist and flips off of it. Instead of doing a twisting vault, she has done a double somersault off. So she's the first back double somersault in the history of women's vaulting. There's only one other double salto vault that was performed, and that was Yelena Protonova back in like 1999 and 2000. Mm.
What did you think when you saw her land this move?
So I was just blown away, and I had seen her training videos, but just to finally see it in competition was genuinely exciting.
Well, the judges scoring her were not as impressed. They gave her a 6.6. That's close to what Biles' other vaults have received. Biles actually spoke to the New York Times about this, and she said, quote, "I feel like now we just have to get what we get because there's no point in putting up a fight because they're not going to reward it." The United States women's national team coordinator, Tom Forster, agreed with Biles that a 6.6 was not high enough. What do we know about how scoring is done?
So those judges at the Classics didn't make this determination. They were told, you know, this is a provisional evaluation that was given by the International Gymnastics Federation, specifically the Women's Technical Committee. So Tom Forster, you know, probably reached out to them to ask, like, what is the approximate valuation for this vault when Simone does it in the Olympics? And they probably then gave that value to the panel of judges at the competition whose job it is to determine the difficulty.
Well, even still, though, the perception is that they've scored her lower than they should have. And this isn't the first skill the 24-year-old has felt undervalued. for by judges. We're just reading that ahead of the 2019 World Championships, Bild expressed how pissed off she was. Those are her words over the gymnastics governing body's unfair valuation of a balance beam dismount. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. I'm just saying that the judges at the Classics aren't responsible, but there is a responsible party, and it's the Women's Technical Committee. Because like you said, in 2019, she submits a skill at the World Championships, and then the WTC will give it a value. She would introduce a double twisting, double somersault off the balance beam. And she got the value of H, which on its face was pretty egregious, because there is this pattern of expected upgrades, like, you know, the double back, I believe, off the beam is a D, and then the full twisting double back will be the G. But then when they were giving her the value for the beam dismount, they were just like, oh, we're just going to make it an H, which means it's just a 1/10 extra over the full twisting double back. And so she expressed her dissatisfaction with what she felt was too low a score.
This sounds very familiar, because we saw something similar with Serena Williams, right? I mean, she actually said in a British Vogue interview that she was, quote, underpaid and undervalued. And she feels like there's a direct line here between how women are scored or thought of in their particular field, specifically in sports, and their race. Is that what we're seeing with Biles?
I think that is definitely what we're seeing with Biles. And there's also a larger context of the general disaster that is the rating system inside the Women's Technical Committee. And I think what that happens is it also becomes this ideal system to hide bias in, because it makes it very difficult to challenge, right? To say, oh, you are treating me unfairly. I definitely agree there's this bias there against her, and also a problematic system in which she is trying to operate, and also some other athletes to sort of point out times when they have been unfairly treated, because the system itself doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, the Tokyo Olympics are this summer, and Biles will compete with the U.S. women's gymnastics team. What should we be looking for?
I mean, beyond the fact that she will, I mean, I hope do this vault, despite the fact that they gave it a 6.6 instead of a 6.8, because it deserves to be showcased at the Olympics, and it deserves to be in the quota point under her name. But I just think that she is going to just showcase why she is the greatest of all time again.
That's DeVore Myers, a freelance journalist and author, talking about Simone Biles. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.